There was a strew of folded papers lying on top of a pair of steno books, the wire-bound ones I keep around for notes and character lists. These had been rubber-banded together. On top of everything else was a shiny black square. Until I picked it up and held it close to the side of the lantern, I didn't realize it was a negative. Ghostly, reversed and faintly orange, I saw Jo in her gray two-piece bathing suit. She was standing on the swimming float with her hands behind her head. "Jo," I said, and then couldn't say anything else. My throat had closed up with tears. I held the negative for a moment, not wanting to lose contact with it, then put it back in the box with the papers and steno books. This stuff was why she had come to Sarah in July of 1994, to gather it up and hide it as well as she could. She had taken the owls off the deck, Frank had heard the door out there bang, and had carried them out here. I could almost see her prying the base off one owl and stuffing the tin box up its plastic wazoo, wrapping both of them in plastic, then dragging them down here, all while her brother sat on the hood of his car smoking Marlboros and feeling the vibrations, the bad vibrations. I doubted if I would ever know all the reasons why she'd done it, or what her frame of mind had been. But she had almost certainly believed I'd find my own way down here eventually. Why else had she left the negative? The loose papers were mostly photocopied press clippings from the Castle Rock Call and the Weekly News, the paper which had apparently preceded the call. The dates were marked on each in my wife's neat, firm hand. The oldest clipping was from 1865 and was headed, "Another Home Safe." The returnee was one Jared DeVore, age 32. Suddenly I understood one of the things that had puzzled me, the generations which didn't seem to match up. A Sarah Tidwell song came to mind as I crouched there on the pallets with my lantern shining down on that old-timey type. It was a ditty that went, "The old folks do it, and the young folks too, and the old folks show the young folks just what to do." By the time Sarah and the Red Top showed up in Castle County and settled on what became known as Tidwell's Meadow, Jared DeVore would have been 67 or 8, old but still hale, a veteran of the Civil War, the sort of older man younger men might look up to. And Sarah's song was right. The old folks show the young folks just what to do. What exactly had they done? The clippings about Sarah and the Red Tops didn't tell. I only skimmed them anyway, but the overall tone shook me just the same. I'd describe it as unfailing genial contempt. The Red Tops were "our southern blackbirds" and "our rhythmic darkies." They were full of dusky good nature. Sarah herself was a marvelous figure of a Negro woman with broad nose, full lips, and noble brow, who fascinated menfolk and womenfolk alike with her animal high spirits, flashing smile, and raucous laugh. They were, God keep us and save us, reviews. Good ones, if you didn't mind being called full of dusky good nature. I shuffled through them quickly, looking for anything about the circumstances under which our southern blackbirds had left. I found nothing. What I found instead was a clipping from the call marked July 19th, go down 19, I thought, 1933. The headline read, "Veteran Guide, Caretaker, Cannot Save Daughter." According to the story, Fred Dean had been fighting the wildfires in the eastern part of the TR with 200 other men when the wind had suddenly changed, menacing the north end of the lake, which had previously been considered safe. At that time, a great many local people had kept fishing and hunting camps up there, this much I knew for myself. The community had had a general store and an actual name, Halo Bay. Fred's wife, Hilda, had been there with the Dean twins, William and Carla, age 3, while her husband was off eating smoke. A good many other wives and kids were in Halo Bay as well. The fires had come fast when the wind changed, the paper said, like marching explosions. They jumped the only firebreak the men had left in that direction and headed for the far end of the lake. At Halo Bay, there were no men to take charge, and apparently no women capable or willing to do so. They panicked instead, racing to load their cars with children and camp possessions, clogging the one road out with their vehicles. Eventually, one of the old cars or trucks broke down, and as the fires roared closer, running through woods that hadn't seen rain since late April, the women who'd waited found their way out blocked. The volunteer firefighters came to the rescue in time, but when Fred Dean got to his wife, one of a party of women trying to push a balky, stalled Ford coupe out of the road, he made a terrible discovery. Billy lay on the floor in the back of the car, fast asleep, but Carla was missing. Hilda had gotten them both in all right. They had been on the back seat, holding hands, just as they always did. But at some point, after her brother had crawled onto the floor and dozed off, and while Hilda was stuffing a few last items into the trunk, Carla must have remembered a toy or a doll and returned to the cottage to get it. While she was doing that, her mother had gotten into their old DeSoto and driven away without rechecking the babies. Carla Dean was either still in the cottage at Halo Bay or making her way up the road on foot. Either way, the fires would run her down. The road was too narrow to get a vehicle turned around and too blocked to get one of those pointed in the right direction through the crush. So Fred Dean, hero that he was, had set off on the run toward the smoke-blackened horizon where bright ribbons of orange had already begun to shine through. The wind-driven fire had crowned and raced to meet him through the treetops like a lover. I knelt on the pallets, reading this by the glow of my lantern, and all at once the smell of fire and burning intensified. I coughed, and then the cough was choked off by the iron taste of water in my mouth and throat. Once again, this time kneeling in the storage area beneath my wife's studio, I felt as if I were drowning. Once again I leaned forward and retched up nothing but a little spit. I turned and saw the lake. The loons were screaming on its hazy surface, making their way toward me in a line, beating their wings against the water as they came. The blue of the sky had been blotted out. The air smelled of charcoal and gunpowder. Ash had begun to sift down from the sky. The eastern verge of Dark Score was in flames, and I could hear occasional muffled reports as hollow trees exploded. They sounded like depth charges. I looked down, wanting to break free of this vision, knowing that in another moment or two it wouldn't be anything so distant as a vision, but as real as the trip Kyra and I had made to the Freiburg Fair. Instead of a plastic owl with gold-ringed eyes, I was looking at a child with bright blue ones. She was sitting on a picnic table, holding out her chubby arms and crying. I saw her as clearly as I saw my own face in the mirror each morning when I shaved. I saw she was about Kyra's age, but much plumper, and her hair is black instead of blonde. Her hair is the shade her brother's will remain until it finally begins to go gray in the impossibly distant summer of 1998, a year she will never see unless someone gets her out of this hell. She wears a white dress and red knee stockings, and she holds her arms out to me, calling, "Daddy, Daddy." I start toward her, and then there is a blast of organized heat that tears me apart for a moment. I am the ghost here, I realize, and Fred Dean has just run right through me. "Daddy," she cries, but to him, not me. "Daddy," and she hugs him, unmindful of the soot smearing on her white silk dress and on her chubby face as he kisses her, and more soot begins to fall, and the loons beat their way in toward shore, seeming to weep in shrill lamentation. "Daddy, the fire is coming," she cries as he scoops her into his arms. "I know. Be brave," he says. "We're gonna be all right, Sugar Plum, but you have to be brave." The fire isn't just coming. It has come. The entire east end of Halo Bay is in flames, and now they're moving this way, eating one by one the little cabins where the men like to lay up drunk in hunting season and ice fishing season. Behind Frank LaRue's, the washing Marguerite hung out that morning is in flames, pants and dresses and underwear burning on lines which are themselves strings of fire. Leaves and bark shower down, a burning ember touches Carla's neck, and she shrieks with pain. Fred slaps it away as he carries her down the slope of land to the water. "Don't do it!" I scream. I know all this is beyond my power to change, but I scream at him anyway, try to change it anyway. "Fight it! For Christ's sake, fight it!" "Daddy, who is that man?" Carla asks, and points at me as the green shingled roof of the Dean place catches fire. Fred glances toward where she is pointing, and in his face I see a spasm of guilt. He knows what he's doing. That's the terrible thing. Way down deep, he knows exactly what he is doing here at Halo Bay, where the street ends. He knows, and he's afraid that someone will witness his work. But he sees nothing. Or does he? There is a momentary doubtful widening of the eyes, as if he does spy something. A dancing helix of air, perhaps. Or does he feel me? Is that it? Does he feel a momentary cold draft in all this heat? One that feels like protesting hands, hands that would restrain if they only had substance? Then he looks away. Then he is wading into the water beside the Dean's stub of a dock. "Fred," I scream. "For God's sake, man, look at her. Do you think your wife put her in a white silk dress by accident? Is that anyone's idea of a play dress?" "Daddy, why are we going in the water?" she asks. "To get away from the fire, Sugar Plum." "Daddy, I can't swim."
"You won't have to," he replies. And what a chill I feel at that.
Because it's no lie. She won't have to swim. Not now. Not ever.
And at least Fred's way will be more merciful than normal Auster's when normal's turn comes. More merciful than the squalling hand pump, the gallons of freezing water. Her white dress floats around her like a lily. Her red stockings shimmer in the water. She hugs his neck tight, and now they are among the fleeing loons. The loons spank the water with their powerful wings, churning up curds of foam and staring at the man and the girl with their distraught red eyes. The air is heavy with smoke and the sky is gone. I stagger after them, waiting. I can feel the cold of the water, although I don't splash and leave no wake. The eastern and northern edges of the lake are both on fire now. There is a burning crescent around us as Fred Dean wades deeper with his daughter, carrying her as if to some baptismal rite. And still he tells himself he is trying to save her, only to save her. Just as all her life, Hilda will tell herself that the child just wandered back to the cottage to look for a toy, that she was not left behind on purpose, left in her white dress and red stockings to be found by her father, who once did something unspeakable. This is the past. This is the land of ago, and here the sins of the fathers are visited on the children, even unto the seventh generation, which is not yet. He takes her deeper, and she begins to scream. Her screams mingle with the screams of the loons until he stops the sound with a kiss upon her terrified mouth. "Love you. Daddy loves his Sugar Plum," he says, and then lowers her. It is to be a full immersion baptism then, except there is no shorebank choir singing "Shall We Gather at the River," and no one shouting "Hallelujah," and he is not letting her come back up. She struggles furiously in the white bloom of her sacrificial dress, and after a moment he cannot bear to watch her. He looks across the lake instead, to the west, where the fire hasn't yet touched and never will. To the west, where skies are still blue. Ash sifts around him like black rain, and the tears pour out of his eyes, and as she struggles furiously beneath his hands, trying to free herself from his drowning grip, he tells himself, "It was an accident. Just a terrible accident. I took her out in the lake because it was the only place I could take her, the only place left. And she panicked. She started to struggle. She was all wet and all slippery, and I lost my good hold on her, and then I lost any hold on her, and then..." I forget I'm a ghost. I scream, "Kaya, hold on, Kai," and die. I reach her. I see her terrified face, her bulging blue eyes, her rosebud of a mouth, which is trailing a silver line of bubbles toward the surface where Fred stands in the water up to his neck, holding her down, while he tells himself over and over that he was trying to save her. It was the only way. He was trying to save her. It was the only way. I reach for her. Again and again I reach for her. My child, my daughter, my Kaya. They are all Kaya, the boys as well as the girls, all my daughter. And each time my arms go through her, worse, oh, far worse, is that now she is reaching for me, her dappled arms floating out, begging for rescue. Her groping hands melt through mine. We cannot touch because now I am the ghost. I am the ghost, and as her struggles weaken, I realize that I can't, oh, I couldn't breathe. I was drowning. I doubled over, opened my mouth, and this time a great spew of lake water came out, soaking the plastic owl which lay on the pallet by my knees. I hugged the Joe's Notions box to my chest, not wanting the contents to get wet, and the movement triggered another retch. This time cold water poured from my nose as well as my mouth. I dragged in a deep breath, then coughed it out. "This has got to end," I said. But of course this was the end, one way or the other, because Kyra was the last. I climbed up the steps to the studio and sat on the littered floor to get my breath. Outside, the thunder boomed and the rain fell, but I thought the storm had passed its peak of fury, or maybe I only hoped. I rested with my legs hanging down through the trap. There were no more ghosts here to touch my ankles. I don't know how I knew that, but I did. And stripped off the rubber bands holding the steno notebooks together. I opened the first one, paged through it, and saw it was almost filled with Joe's handwriting and a number of folded, typed sheets, single-spaced. The fruit of all those clandestine trips down to the TR during the fall of 1993 and the spring of 1994. Fragmentary notes, for the most part, and transcriptions of tapes, which might still be down below me in the storage space somewhere. Tucked away with the VCR or the 8-track player, perhaps. But I didn't need them. When the time came, if the time came, I was sure I'd find most of the story here. What had happened, who had done it, how it was covered up. Right now, I didn't care. Right now, I only wanted to make sure that Kyra was safe and stayed safe. There was only one way to do that. Lie still. I attempted to slip the rubber bands around the steno books again, and the one I hadn't looked at slipped out of my wet hand and fell to the floor. A torn slip of green paper fell out. I picked it up and saw it was a scratch of genealogy. It showed my own line. James Noonan, born in 1868, begat Paul Noonan, born in 1892. Paul fathered Jack, born in 1920, and Jack fathered Sid in 56 and Mike in 58. Mike and Joe would have fathered the child Joe had referred to as R. Kai, with a question mark afterward. What I didn't know, what perhaps even my brother Sid hadn't known, was that James Noonan had had an older sister named Bridget, born in 1866. Bridget had married a man named Benton Oster. In Motton, Joe had scribbled in the margin of her genealogy. They'd had a son, Harry Oster, born in 1885. Harry's son, Normal, had been born in 1915. In 1940 had come Kenny. In 1943, the unfortunate Carrie. Kenny had two kids, David and Keisha. Keisha, Joe had for some reason marked as safe. For a moment, I came out of that strange and heightened awareness I'd been living in. The world fell back into its accustomed dimensions. But the colors were all too strong somehow, objects too emphatically present. I felt like a battlefield soldier suddenly illuminated by a ghastly white flare, one that shows everything. My father's people had come from the neck. I had been right about that much. My great-grandfather, according to this, was James Noonan, and he had never shit in the same pit with Jared DeVore. Max DeVore had either been lying when he said that to Maddie, or misinformed, or simply confused, the way folks often get confused when they reach their 80s. Even a fellow like DeVore, who had stayed mostly sharp, wouldn't have been exempt from the occasional nick in his edge. And he hadn't been that far off at that, because, according to this little scratch of a chart, my great-grandfather's older sister Bridget had married Harry Oster, born of Benton Oster and Bridget Noonan Oster, in the year 1885. Christ Jesus, I whispered. Kenny Oster's grandfather was my granduncle, and he was one of them. Whatever they did, Harry Oster was one of them. He's related to me. That's the connection. I thought of Kyra with sudden, sharp terror. She had been up at the house by herself for nearly an hour. How could I have been so stupid? Anyone could have come in while I was under the studio. Sarah could have used anyone to... I realized that wasn't true. The murderers and the child victims had all been linked by blood, and now that blood had thinned. That river had almost reached the sea. There was Bill Dean, but he was staying well away from Sarah Laughs. There was Kenny Oster, but Kenny had taken himself and his family off to Taxachusetts. And Kai's closest blood relations, mother, father, grandfather, were all dead. Only I was left. Only I was blood. Only I could do it. Unless... I bolted back up to the house as fast as I could, slipping and sliding my way along the soaked path, desperate to make sure she was all right. I didn't think Sarah could hurt Kyra herself, no matter how much of that old-timer vibe she had to draw on. But what if I was wrong? What if I was wrong?
I ain't gonna hurt her, honey. Not for all the treasure in the world. No, no, no. I ain't gonna hurt her, honey. Won't hurt you, baby. Not for diamonds, nor for pearls. No, no, no. Only warm, left-hearted bastard. Dare to touch that little girl.
Kai lay fast asleep just as I had left her, on her side with the filthy little stuffed dog clutched under her jaw. It had put a smudge on her neck, but I hadn't the heart to take it away from her. Beyond her and to the left, through the open bathroom door, I could hear the steady plink, plonk, plink of water falling off the faucet and into the tub. Cool air blew around me in a silky twist, caressing my cheeks, sending a not unpleasurable shiver up my back. In the living room, Bunter's bell gave a dim little shake.
"Water still warm, sugar," Sarah whispered. "Be a friend. Be a daddy. Go on now. Do what I want. Do what we both want."
And I did want to, which had to be why Joe at first tried to keep me away from the TR and from Sarah Laughs. Why she'd made a secret of her possible pregnancy as well. It was as if I had discovered a vampire inside me, a creature with no interest in what it thought of as talk show conscience and op-ed page morality. A part that wanted only to take Kai into the bathroom and dunk her into that tub of warm water and hold her under, watching the red-edged white ribbons shimmer the way Carla Dean's white dress and red stockings had shimmered while the woods burned all around her and her father. A part of me would be more than glad to pay the last installment on that old bill. "Dear God," I muttered, and wiped my face with a shaking hand. "She knows so many tricks. And she's so fucking strong." The bathroom door tried to swing shut against me before I could go through, but I pushed it open against hardly any resistance. The medicine cabinet door banged back, and the glass shattered against the wall. The stuff inside flew out at me, but it wasn't a very dangerous attack. This time, most of the missiles consisted of toothpaste tubes, toothbrushes, plastic bottles, and a few old Vicks inhalers. Faint, very faint, I could hear her shouting in frustration as I yanked the plug at the bottom of the tub and let the water start gurgling out. There had been enough drowning on the TR for one century, by God. And yet, for a moment, I felt an incredibly strong urge to put the plug back in while the water was still deep enough to do the job. Instead, I tore it off its chain and threw it down the hall. The medicine cabinet door clapped shut again, and the rest of the glass fell out. "How many of you had?" I asked her. "How many besides Carla Dean and Carrie Oster and Arkaya? 2? 3? 5? How many do you need before you can rest?" "All of them," the answer shot back. It wasn't just Sarah's voice, either. It was my own as well. She'd gotten into me, had snuck in by way of the basement like a burglar. And already I was thinking that even if the tub was empty and the water pump temporarily dead, there was always the lake. "All of them," the voice cried again. "All of them, sugar." Of course. Only all of them would do. Until then, there would be no rest for Sarah Laughs. "I'll help you to rest," I said. "That I promise." The last of the water swirled away. But there was always the lake if I changed my mind. I left the bathroom and looked in on Kai again. She hadn't moved. The sensation that Sarah was in here with me had gone. Bunter's bell was quiet. And yet, I felt uneasy, unwilling to leave her alone. I had to, though, if I were to finish my work, and I would do well not to linger. County and state cops would be along eventually, storm or no storm, down trees or no down trees. "Yes, but..." I stepped into the hall and looked uneasily around. Thunder boomed, but it was losing some of its urgency. So was the wind. What wasn't fading was the sense of something watching me, something that was not Sarah. I stood where I was a moment or two longer, trying to tell myself it was just the sizzle of my overcooked nerves, then walked down the hall to the entry. I opened the door to the stoop, then looked around again sharply, as if expecting to see someone or something lurking behind the far end of the bookcase. A shape, perhaps. Something that still wanted its dust catcher. But I was the only shape left, at least in this part of the world, and the only movement I saw was ripple shadows thrown by the rain rolling down the windows. It was still coming down hard enough to re-drench me as I crossed my stoop to the driveway, but I paid no attention. I had just been with a little girl when she drowned, had damn near drowned myself not so long ago, and the rain wasn't going to stop me from doing what I had to do. I picked up the fallen branch, which had dented the roof of my car, tossed it aside, and opened the Chevy's rear door. The things I'd bought at Slips and Greens were still sitting on the back seat, still tucked into the cloth carry-handle bag Lila Prue had given me. The trowel and the pruning knife were visible, but the third item was in a plastic sack. "Do you want this one in a special bag?" Lila had asked me. "Best to be safe." And later, as I was leaving, she had spoken of Kenny's dog Blueberry chasing seagulls and had given out with a big, hearty laugh. Her eyes hadn't laughed, though. Maybe that's how you tell the Martians from the Earthlings. The Martians can never laugh with their eyes. I saw Rami and George's present lying on the front seat, the steno mask I'd at first mistaken for DeVore's oxygen mask. The boys in the basement spoke up then, murmured at least, and I leaned over the seat to grab the mask by its elastic strap without the slightest idea of why I was doing so. I dropped it into the carry bag, slammed the car door, then started down the railroad tie steps to the lake. On the way, I paused to duck under the deck, where we had always kept a few tools. There was no pick, but I grabbed a spade that looked up to a piece of grave digging. Then, for what I thought would be the last time, I followed the course of my dream down to the street. I didn't need Joe to show me the spot. The Green Lady had been pointing to it all along. Even had she not been, and even if Sarah Tidwell did not stink to the heavens, I think I would have known. I think I would have been led there by my own haunted heart. There was a man standing between me and the place where the gray forehead of rock guarded the path. and as I paused on the last railroad tie, he hailed me in a rasping voice that I knew all too well. "Say there, whoremaster, where's your whore?" He stood on the street in the pouring rain, but his cutter's outfit, green flannel pants, checked wool shirt, and his faded blue Union Army cap were dry, because the rain was falling through him rather than on him. He looked solid, but he was no more real than Sarah herself. I reminded myself of this as I stepped down onto the path to face him, but my heart continued to speed up, thudding in my chest like a padded hammer. He was dressed in Jared DeVore's clothes, but this wasn't Jared DeVore. This was Jared's great-grandson, Max, who had begun his career with an act of sled theft and ended it in suicide, but not before arranging for the murder of his daughter-in-law, who'd had the temerity to refuse him what he had so dearly wanted. I started toward him, and he moved to the center of the path to block me. I could feel the cold baking off him. I am saying exactly what I mean, expressing what I remember as clearly as I can. I could feel the cold baking off him. And yes, it was Max DeVore, all right, but got up like a logger at a costume party and looking the way he must have around the time his son Lance was born. Old but hale. The sort of man younger men might well look up to. And now, as if the thought had called them, I could see the rest shimmer into faint being behind him, standing in a line across the path. These were the ones who had been with Jared at the Freiburg Fair, and now I knew who some of them were. Fred Dean, of course, only 19 years old in 01, the drowning of his daughter still over 30 years away. And the one who had reminded me of myself was Harry Oster, my great-aunt's firstborn. He would have been 16, barely old enough to raise a fuzz, but old enough to work in the woods with Jared, old enough to shit in the same pit as Jared, to mistake Jared's poison for wisdom. One of the others twisted his head and squinted at the same time. I'd seen that tick before. Where? Then it came to me, in the Lakeview General. This young man was the late Royce Merrill's father. The others I didn't know, nor did I care to. "You ain't a-passin' by us," DeVore said. He held up both hands. "Don't even think about trying. Am I right, boys?" They murmured growling agreement, the sort you could hear coming from any present-day gang of headbangers or taggers, I imagine. But their voices were distant, actually more sad than menacing. There was some substance to the man in Jared DeVore's clothes, perhaps because in life he had been a man of enormous vitality, perhaps because he was so recently dead, but the others were little more than projected images. I started forward, moving into that baking cold, moving into the smell of him, the same invalid odors which had surrounded him when I'd met him here before. "Where do you think you're going?" he cried. "For a constitutional," I said. "And no law against it. The street's the place where good pups and vile dogs can walk side by side. You said so yourself." "You don't understand," Max Jared said. "You never will. You're not of that world. That was our world." I stopped, looking at him curiously. Time was short. I wanted to be done with this. But I had to know, and I thought DeVore was ready to tell me. "Make me understand," I said. "Convince me that any world was your world." I looked at him, then at the flickering, translucent figures behind him, gauze flesh heaped on shining bones. "Tell me what you did."
"It was all different then," DeVore said. "When you come down here, Noonan, you might walk all 3 miles north to Halo Bay and see only a dozen people on the street. After Labor Day, you might not see anyone at all. This side of the lake, you have to walk through the bushes that are growing up wild and around fallen trees. There'll be even more of them after this storm. And even a deadfall or two, because nowadays the townsfolk don't club together to keep it neat the way they used to. But in our time, the woods were bigger then, Noonan. Distances were farther to go, and neighboring meant something. Life itself, often enough. Back then, this really was a street. Can you see?"
I could. If I looked through the phantom shapes of Fred Dean and Harry Oster and the others, I could. They weren't just ghosts. They were shimmer glass windows on another age. I saw a summer afternoon in the year of 1898, perhaps 1902, 1907, doesn't matter. This is a period when all time seems the same, as if time has stopped. This is a time the old-timers remember as a kind of golden age. It is the land of ago, the kingdom of when I was a boy. The sun washes everything with the fine gold light of endless late July. The lake is as blue as a dream, netted with a billion sparks of reflected light. And the street. It is as smoothly grassed as a lawn and as broad as a boulevard. It is a boulevard, I see. A place where the community fully realizes itself. It is the main conduit of communication, the chief cable in a township crisscrossed with them. I'd felt the existence of these cables all along. Even when Joe was alive, I felt them under the surface. And here is their point of origin. Folks promenade on the street. All up and down the east side of Darkscore Lake, they promenade in little groups, laughing and conversing under a cloud-stacked summer sky. And this is where the cables all begin. I look and realize how wrong I have been to think of them as Martians, as cruel and calculating aliens. East of their sunny promenade looms the darkness of the woods, glades and hollows where any miserable thing may await, from a foot lopped off in a logging accident to a birth gone wrong and a young mother dead before the doctor can arrive from Castle Rock in his buggy. These are people with no electricity, no phones, no county rescue unit, no one to rely upon but each other and a god some of them have already begun to mistrust. They live in the woods and the shadows of the woods, but on fine summer afternoons they come to the edge of the lake. They come to the street and look in each other's faces and laugh together, and then they are truly on the TR, in what I have come to think of as the zone. They are not Martians. They are little lives dwelling on the edge of the dark, that's all. I see summer people from Warrington's, the men dressed in white flannels, two women in long tennis dresses still carrying their rackets. A fellow riding a tricycle with an enormous front wheel weaves shakily among them. The party of summer folk has stopped to talk with a group of young men from town. The fellows from away want to know if they can play in the townies' baseball game at Warrington's on Tuesday night. Ben Merrill, Royce's father-to-be, says, "Yeah, but we won't go easy on you just because you're from New York." The young men laugh. So do the tennis girls. A little further on, two boys are playing catch with a sort of raw homemade baseball that is known as a horsey. Beyond them is a convention of young mothers talking earnestly of their babies, all safely prammed and gathered in their own group. Men in overalls discuss weather and crops, politics and crops, taxes and crops. A teacher from the Consolidated High sits on the gray stone forehead I know so well, patiently tutoring a sullen boy who wants to be somewhere else and doing anything else. I think the boy will grow up to be Buddy Jellison's father. Horn broken, watch for finger, I think. All along the street, folks are fishing, and they are catching plenty. The lake fairly teems with bass and trout and pickerel. An artist, another summer fellow, judging from his smock and Nancy beret, has set up his easel and is painting the mountains while two ladies watch respectfully. A giggle of girls passes, whispering about boys and clothes and school. There is beauty here and peace. DeVore's right to say, "This is a world I never knew. It's beautiful," I said, pulling myself back with an effort. "Yes, I see that, but what's your point?"
"My point?"
DeVore looked almost comically surprised.
"She thought she could walk there like everyone else. That's the fucking point. She thought she could walk there like a white gal. Her and her big teeth and her big tits and her snotty looks. She thought she was something special, but we taught her different. She tried to walk me down, and when she couldn't do that, she put her filthy hands on me and tumped me over. But that was all right. We taught her manners, didn't we, boys?"
They growled agreement, but I thought some of them,
Young Harry Oster, for one, looked sick.
"We taught her her place," DeVore said. "We taught her she wasn't nothing but a..."
"Nigger." This is the word he uses over and over again when they are in the woods that summer. The summer of 1901, the summer that Sarah and the Red Tops become the musical act to see in this part of the world. She and her brother and their whole nigger family have been invited to Warrington's to play for the summer people. They have been fed on champagne and oysters, or so says Jared DeVore to his little school of devoted followers, as they eat their own plain lunches of bread and meat and salted cucumbers out of lard buckets given to them by their mothers. None of the young men are married, although Orrin Peebles is engaged. Yet, it isn't her growing renown that upsets Jared DeVore. It isn't the fact that she's been to Warrington's. It don't cross his eyes none that she and that brother of hers have actually sat down and eaten with white folks, taken bread from the same bowl as them with their black nigger fingers. The folks at Warrington's are flatlanders, after all, and DeVore tells the silent, attentive young men that he's heard that in places like New York and Chicago, white women sometimes even fuck black niggers. "Naw," Harry Oster says, looking around nervously, as if he expected a few white women to come tripping through the woods way out here on Bowie Ridge. "No white woman would fuck a nigger. Shoot a pickle." DeVore only gives him a look, the kind that says, "When you're my age." Besides, he doesn't care what goes on in New York and Chicago. He saw all the flatlands he wanted to during the Civil War. And, he will tell you, he never fought that war to free the damned slaves. They can keep slaves down there in the land of cotton until the end of eternity, as far as Jared Lancelot DeVore is concerned. No, he fought the war to teach those cracker sons of bitches south of Mason and Dixon that you don't pull out of the game just because you don't like some of the rules. He went down to scratch the scab off the end of old Johnny Reb's nose. Tried to leave the United States of America, they had. The Lord. No, he doesn't care about slaves, and he doesn't care about the land of cotton, and he doesn't care about black niggers who sing dirty songs and then get treated to champagne and oysters. Jared always says oysters in just that sarcastic way, in payment for their smut. He doesn't care about anything so long as they keep in their place and let him keep in his. But she won't do it. The uppity bitch will not do it. She has been warned to stay off the street, but she will not listen. She goes anyway, walking along in her white dress, just as if there were a white person inside it, sometimes with her son, who has a black nigger African name and no daddy. His daddy probably spent the one night with his mommy in a haystack somewhere down in Alabama, and now she walks around with the get of that just as bold as a brass monkey. She walks the street as if she has a right to be there, even though not a soul will talk to her. "But that's not true, is it?" I asked DeVore. "That's what really stuck in old great-granddaddy's craw, wasn't it? They did talk to her. She had a way about her, that laugh, maybe. Men talked to her about crops, and women showed off their babies. In fact, they gave her their babies to hold, and when she laughed down at them, they laughed back up at her. The girls asked her advice about boys. The boys, they just looked. But how they looked, huh? They filled up their eyes, and I expect most of them thought about her when they went out to the privy and filled up their palms." DeVore glowered. He was aging in front of me, the lines drawing themselves deeper and deeper into his face. He was becoming the man who had knocked me into the lake because he couldn't bear to be crossed. And as he grew older, he began to fade. That's what Jared hated most of all, wasn't it? That they didn't turn aside. Didn't turn away. She walked on the street, and no one treated her like a nigger. They treated her like a neighbor. I was in the zone, deeper in than I'd ever been, down where the town's unconscious seemed to run like a buried river. I could drink from that river while I was in the zone, could fill my mouth and throat and belly with its cold, minerally taste. All that summer, DeVore had talked to them. They were more than his crew. They were his boys, Fred and Harry and Ben and Orrin and George and Draper Finney, who would break his neck and drown the next summer trying to dive into Eads Quarry while he was drunk. Only it was the sort of accident that's kind of on purpose.
Draper Finney drank a lot between July of 1901 and August of 1902 because it was the only way he could sleep, the only way he could get the hand out of his mind, that hand sticking straight out of the water, clenching and unclenching until you wanted to scream, "Won't it stop? Won't it ever stop doing that?" All summer long, Jared DeVore filled their ears with "nigger bitch" and "uppity bitch." All summer long, he told them about their responsibility as men, their duty to keep the community pure, and how they must see what others didn't and do what others wouldn't.